Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I want to welcome back on our show today Dr. Jameel Battle and our guest that we're going to be talking with later, Iqbal Mian, who works with Practice Green Health, an organization that is a partnership between the Environmental Protection Agency, the American Hospital Association, the American Nurses Association, and Healthcare Without Harm, and addressing sustainability in hospitals. A really important issue as we think about hospitals and the healthcare industry going green. First, though, we're going to actually talk about some research that matters, Jameela. And our very first research is about music and exercise. Which one of those do you like better?
I like both. I just did my triathlon this past weekend.
And no
I
way.
Had my music bumping.
So you were playing music while you were running?
Yes.
And biking.
And
not
biking.
Swimming. Not swimming.
Not swimming.
Well, you're doing exactly kind of what they're talking about, which is the motivation to exercise by listening to music. And I had never really thought about this, but they call it high-intensity interval training. So you take these brief runs, but you then accelerate, and then you take a rest, and you accelerate, and then take a rest. And they say that's a hard thing for some people to do, to motivate themselves. And they were wondering, could music motivate them?
And the answer, this was done by Matthew Stork, a postdoctoral fellow in the School of Health and Sciences at Brunel University. It looks like what he did is he gathered a panel of British adults to rate motivational qualities of 16 fast tempo songs. And so three songs with the highest motivational qualities were selected.
And they were working with some colleagues over in British Columbia. I think I want to go visit both places myself. And they were comparing this motivational music compared to no music whatsoever or a podcast. And what did they find?
So they separated a group of 24 participants, and there was this one-minute workout, three 20-second all-out sprints totaling 60 seconds of hard work. And what they found is the participants that reported greater enjoyment were the ones that had the motivational music.
Which would make sense at some levels, but they also found that it wasn't just about greater kind of enjoyment. Their heart rates were actually higher, which meant that to me that they were maybe working out more intensely, not just that the music kind of elevated their heart rate.
But exactly.
It was kind of a win-win for these participants.
Exactly. And so the thought is that humans have an innate tendency to alter the frequency of their biological rhythms toward that of musical rhythms.
Let's go from the frying pan into the fire. And this is about marijuana use, but it's not just about marijuana use as we've been talking about it, but marijuana use during pregnancy.
And people are looking at this because legalization, I think in part, is why, you know, more people in general are using marijuana. People assume it's safe. But Dr. Nora Vulcan, director of the National Institute of Drug Abuse, looked at basically U.S. women using pot during pregnancy and found that between 2002 and 2017, the rate of use doubled. And this was published in JAMA.
All right, Journal of the American Medical Association, major journal.
Yeah.
It was 3.4% to 7% of pregnant women overall, and daily use increased from about 1% to 3.4%. You know, I mean, these are major increases here. And mostly was concentrated in the first trimester. So maybe these women were using it to combat nausea rather than taking prescription medicines. But on the other hand, it seems to be concerning because there are adverse effects on the fetus, potentially, of marijuana use in pregnancy, right?
That's right. Another study in Canada published in the same journal found that the babies that were born to pregnant women who smoked marijuana were likely to be born early, at a lower weight, and to be transferred to the neonatal intensive unit.
I think that's worrisome. I think the study is worrisome. I think we need to reevaluate what are the messages that we're giving to people about marijuana use, and certainly in pregnancy, no medications, prescribed or unprescribed, would be considered safe without, I think, going through your doctor. And certainly marijuana use, I think, falls into that realm.
It certainly does, especially since we also don't know the full impact on our fetuses, but this is a rapid development time and they're very vulnerable.
The last research that matters isn't so much research as it is the research that we were doing, Jamila and I, to look at some data. We were seeing all these people who have recently been traveling and are traveling in summer and fall and vacations and our own vacations, and we increasingly hear that there are concerns about safety in many countries of the world. Not like it's totally completely safe in the United States, but how do you know what the major risk factors are for perhaps what we'd call death? And there's a website, right?
There is a website.
It's called travel.state.gov. Again, that's travel.state.gov. We're going to have a great health science librarian put up a link to this site on our website by the U.S. Department of State. And you can actually look up this death of United States citizens overseas by month, by year, every country in the world.
That's pretty amazing.
What did we discover about Spain?
We discovered that in Spain that it was actually, what was that, pretty safe?
An entire year there had been like three or four deaths, mostly like motor vehicle accidents, we discovered. In many places, like you were thinking about taking the family down to Costa Rica. What would be one of the major causes of death in Costa Rica?
That was drowning.
So. It was drowning. In Vietnam, the major cause of death of U.S. citizens was suicide. In many cases, we can understand motor vehicle accidents, drownings, and in some countries, homicide. We saw, you know, some countries had very high rates of homicide, didn't we?
It was one in particular, Haiti.
Again, we don't know why the citizens are going there, what they're doing, but we would suggest you go to this website, look at the country you're going to go to, see what the major cause of death is, and then do what you can to protect yourself. That'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we're going to hear about our interview with Iqbal Mien of Practice Green Health about the ways that the healthcare industry can, must, should, and is going green. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamil Battle. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. Today on Conversations, we're talking with Iqbal Mien of Practice Green Health, an organization that began as a partnership between the Environmental Protection Agency, the American Hospital Association, the American Nurses Association, and Healthcare Without Harm as a way to address sustainability in hospitals about ways the healthcare industry can go green. Welcome to Your Health, Iqbal.
Thank you so much, Adam. Pleasure to be here.
This is an exciting topic for so many reasons, but it's not one that if you were to ask our typical health listener, give me the top 10 health topics you think that you'd like us to address. I'm not sure it would fall into that, but yet they would all say, God, I'd love to hear about this. Is that a surprise to you?
You know, because of the audiences that I interact with, whether it's universities, you know, various students and, you know, other health professionals. You know, I live and breathe this world, so it's becoming a topic of conversation at coffee shops, at happy hours, at break room meetings in hospitals. And more recently, we've done a little study on the demographics of healthcare, and millennials are entering healthcare at higher rates. And this is something that they care about, sustainability. So the culture of these facilities, whether they're able to do it, have language around it, it all matters, and it's becoming a topping point that's, I think, reaching national levels.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, Iqbal. How did you get interested in healthcare and sustainability issues as it relates to that?
Yeah, Adam, you know, if we took a snapshot of 2019, rewound the clock to 2009, and then rewound the clock, you know, 10 years even before that, sustainability, the word has been around, but there haven't been many positions dedicated to it. And in healthcare in the last 10 years, we're seeing a lot more formal roles of sustainability. So how I got into it was in business school in 2008, I was challenging my professors saying that, hey, I would love to take this degree of supply chain operations management and apply it to healthcare because we're looking at all of the inputs and outputs. It has impact on society, on people, on environmental resources. And sustainability is really how can you sustain those operations without negatively impacting those key themes that I just mentioned. And so the university said, well, the degree is not really designed for that, but, you know, good luck and we'll help you along the way. I then went around the country and tried to convince healthcare leaders that, hey, hire me as a sustainability leader. I'll help, you know, look at those operations and measure impact. And ultimately what ended up happening in 2008, I ran out of funds and I moved back to my hometown in Wisconsin, ran into my pediatrician who said, hey, I know a local leader that's working on sustainability. So to make a long story short, I ended up working for this leader for 9 months as a sustainability leader for free. And the impact was so profound that we were able to turn that into a full-time position. So my journey began kind of trying to make the business case for sustainability positions. And Adam, if you fast forward to today, you'll see that many healthcare systems have formal sustainability roles. In fact, in Wisconsin, one of the first medical director of sustainability positions became formal through UW Health in Madison. And we also have other healthcare systems, you know, designing those same positions. So you're absolutely right. It's a very exciting time to look at this subject of sustainability in healthcare.
And UW is University of Wisconsin. So just for our listeners who may not know the lingo. Speaking of lingo, we talk about sustainability. You know, think about, like, when did I first hear about sustainability? Well, and it certainly was probably in architecture and commercial buildings. When did it come involved into really healthcare and organizational healthcare, which is, you know, what you were studying in business school?
Yeah, so let me speak through the lens of healthcare without harm and practice green health. So if you go to our website, noharm.org or practicegreenhealth.org, you'll see that there are several specific areas of sustainability that we've defined. And in practice green health, there are actually 11 areas. And ultimately, all of them stem from the original definition set by the United Nations in 1985. It's, you know, can you meet the needs of the future without compromising current needs? And so we look at, you know, water, energy, safer chemicals, greening the OR, the food systems, and so on, as it relates to the resources required for healthcare and how long we can sustain those resources to run operations. So we have been able to take that very powerful definition and operationalize it in 11 areas. And I know that can be a little overwhelming, but there are very key specific things that we look at.
Give us an example of, one or two of those and maybe what's being done.
Absolutely. So let's shine a spotlight on energy and water. So it might not surprise your audience to know that hospitals by building type are the single largest users of water. And if we look at energy, we're the second largest users of energy next to restaurants. And so the byproducts of using energy emits different byproducts in the atmosphere, and most of those energy sources are from fossil fuels. So some of the specific tactics that we have is we help coach hospitals on how to, do root cause analysis. How do you identify where your largest loads of energy or water are, and then what specific services and products can you install to mitigate and reduce those operations? And if you don't mind, I think one of the most interesting analogies that I like to use is Roger Bannister and Eliud Kipchoge, who just broke the 2-hour marathon, and Roger Bannister, who broke the 4-minute mile. You know, as soon as those folks have been able to do it, many other folks, you know, have been inspired, follow, and break the record. And now in healthcare, you know, we have over 14 healthcare systems that have declared carbon neutrality by specific dates. that was something that was unheard of years ago. And, you know, now we have those bold declarations. So it's very doable. And those are just two areas in which, you know, hospitals and healthcare systems are making big dents.
Give us an example of what's happening on the ground, because I know working at the University of North Carolina healthcare system, you know, we have over a dozen hospitals across the state, you know, multi-billion dollar healthcare system. This is not easy work.
No, it definitely isn't. And resources are limited. And if you look at the triple aim, which now has morphed into the quadruple aim, adding the goal of improving work-life balance, because, you know, physician burnout is it's a real thing. So it's kind of a regional solution. You know, there are amazing things that happen when you look at what local resources are available. In the instance for Gunderson Health in La Crosse, Wisconsin, in 2008, Dr. Jeff Thompson, their CEO at the time, said that their healthcare system by 2014 would produce more energy than they needed. And they did this by looking at their local landfill and asking, hey, what are you guys doing with your excess methane? Can we pipe it over to the hospital and, you know, turn that through an electric generator and consume the electricity that we make from it? They looked at the excess discharge from a brewery down the street and piped that over to the hospital. And then they started doing energy conservation measures. And then they looked at buying, you know, solar panels for their rooftop. And then they bought off-wind renewable energy credits. And then all of a sudden, one day in 2014, they produced more energy than they needed. They had hit their goal. So it's really exciting that someone like that has been able to look at, you know, local solutions and looking in their backyard for extra resources that they never would have looked unless they had made such a bold goal.
I would imagine that many providers in that healthcare system feel very proud of that accomplishment.
Oh, absolutely. And for Dr. Jeff Thompson, I'm doing a little plug-in for his book. He wrote a book shortly after called Lead True, and it talks about value-based decision-making. Sometimes when it's the right thing to do, you know, in this case, sustainability, the financials and, you know, the economics are hard to discuss. But if you look at it through the lens of health and long-term community impact, it's a no-brainer. And if you look at the emissions that healthcare emits annually and ranked it as a country, we'd be number 5. So in our Hippocratic oath of do no harm, you can quickly see how this becomes, you know, an accountability back to us.
Okay, so you've moved on my topic. I said it went in the first 10. If we ask people, okay, we're now up to number 5, and I bet when we get done, we're going to be number 1. But we're going to have to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to continue talking with Iqbal Amian, who is really an advocate and an expert in the business and the healthcare of sustainability and the merger of those two areas. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Iqbal Amian of Practice Green Health, an organization that's a partnership between multiple major national players in healthcare, the Environmental Protection Agency, the American Hospital Association, American Nurses Association, and Healthcare Without Harm, looking at sustainability in hospitals and the way the healthcare industry can go green. And right before the break, Iqbal, you'd given a wonderful example of leadership in sustainability in health systems, really surplus energy and the use of electricity and water. Talk to me about any effort that maybe involves sustainability and quality of care and the cost of care and the outcomes of care.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give you a couple different flavors. So, you know, the quick story that I had before on how I landed my role as a sustainability leader, many of my first projects were looking at the built environment, you know, the actual square footage of hospitals, and boy, is it's expensive to build in healthcare, whether it's existing building renovation or expanding. It's just costly by square foot. And so what we really looked at is what is the actual patient care experience? Because again, each additional square foot has dollar, and we want to add value, and we want to reduce wait times. We want to get patients, you know, in and out without readmits and, you know, potential health defects. So from the construction side, you know, as of 2009 and onward, if you look at LEED for Healthcare, which is Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, they kind of help building owners like the hospitals. And the construction teams look at a plethora of specific items in the construction of the hospital. So avoiding chemicals of concerns, looking at the acoustics for patients as they're recovering, looking at lighting systems. We know that natural lighting has a positive impact on patients. And if you read the book, The Nature Principle, we also know that biodiversity helps patients escape the mechanical world. So all of that goes into the construction of hospitals, and the more, you know, modern hospitals that you're seeing are integrating these natural designs, which impact patient care altogether. And if you're a good healthcare system, you're going to measure that impact in pre and post surveys. So that's something that we're seeing healthcare systems do much more on the built environment side. And then let me give you another example from Pennsylvania. This is Geisinger Health. I had a really nice opportunity to chat with Al Neuner, who is their VP of Facilities, and he looks at the impact of health population through how much energy they save year over year. So Al uses this tool called the Energy Impact Calculator. It's free and available online through our organization. And what it does is it looks at your zip code and it looks at your electrical usage and calculates that into climate health impact. So basically for Al, he runs a report that shows the electrical savings that they did in a calendar year and how that translates to the number of respiratory illnesses they prevented, the number of work loss days they prevented, and then the societal and medical dollar impact. And all of that is calculated through this tool. And he shows that to their chief financial officer and their chief medical officer, and he gets approval for their capital funding. And again, they also show how their local health population is impacted by those energy savings. So making all of these connected dots is very crucial. And systems like Geisinger, they've been able to really prove that impact. In fact, some of their hospitals are now dollar operating cost is lower than a residential home. Like if you looked at the square footage and how much energy it requires to heat and cool that space, he's competing at a residential level for some of their properties. So that's super impressive.
Yeah, no, it's exciting. And to think about all the ways that this impacts, you know, the daily experience of healthcare, you know, I'm thinking about how you serve the food that you serve in the healthcare systems. And when patients come in and providers go, you know, we have a great food delivery service here. We bring in fresh, sustainable food from local communities because of how much food is served there. But I wonder about other things like, you know, hospitals use a lot of single-use plastics for sterility. What do we do with that?
Yeah, that's a major concern right now, especially as the plastic markets are starting to, you know, close up shop in certain areas of the country. We have a wonderful initiative called Greening the OR, and there's a checklist that you can actually obtain. It's free through our website, and the checklist has 50 items. This is ideally something that you would walk the OR floors and check off as you make these observations. So, Adam, there's a whole section on there on basically environmental preferable purchasing and your supply chain. What are the plastics and products that you're purchasing in the hospital? And then kind of aggregating them and looking at where they're, you know, not only coming into the hospital door, how they're being used, you know, in the ORs, and then how they're being disposed of, you know, basically looking at cradle to grave. And so once you start doing that checklist, you start realizing the volume of products that we go through. The ORs produce about 20% of the physical waste of a hospital. So it's a large category, and it's also one of the largest revenue generators. So through greening the OR, we know that there's approximately $25,000 savings per OR room if you go after reducing your plastics, if you go after looking at the lighting that's in the ORs, the air exchange rates in the ORs, and again, what you're purchasing. So that's a massive initiative, and we need clinical champions to, you know, kind of shine the spotlight on it. If you don't mind, one quick story I have is from the University of Wisconsin, UW Health, again, in Madison, Wisconsin. Their anesthesiologist was able to basically collect all of the plastic caps from different vial containers over a one-month period and then basically put it on the break room and show her colleagues, you know, take a look at the volume that we go through. You know, this isn't right. We have to do something with this. So she was able to get buy-in from fellow clinicians just from seeing the sheer volume of plastics that come through their ORs. By the way, they've commissioned an artist now to take those plastics and turn it into art installations. So just kind of neat to see how creative some people can be with the different waste streams that come out. And they also did something amazing. They got rid of desflurane, which is, we know, is one of the anesthetic gases that is very potent in its global warming potential. It doesn't need to be on the formulary, and now they're saving $20,000 a month, and it's the equivalent of taking 984 cars off the road. So right there, that's one huge area where there's operational dollar savings, and it's just from greening the OR.
Okay, so now you've moved up to number one. Okay, you did it. The challenge was out there. The last question I really have is, how do you sustain your organization, the work that you're doing? How's that going?
Our model is very interactive with hospitals. So regionally, there's folks like myself. We're member engagement managers. We connect directly with the hospitals, work with them on their sustainability plans, their objectives, you know, giving them feedback. And then in turn, we also hold cohorts in which folks from around the country call in on different topics. So there's one that I run called the Great Lakes Cohort. There's about 15 healthcare systems along the Great Lakes. We talk monthly on topics that they care about. In Minnesota and Wisconsin, we've been having record rainfall this year. And with some of the climate change, you know, weather forecasts, hospitals have to get pretty serious because we want to stay open during turbulent weather events. And so our organization fosters those platforms for hospitals to talk to each other, to share best practices. Last week, we had our Healthcare Climate Council, which is about 19 of our healthcare members, go to Washington, D.C. and advocate to the Climate Committee on what are some of the best practices that can be considered for the country. And they outlined 11 different policy agenda items for senators. So those are all driven from our hospitals. And again, we're having those wonderful dialogues, you know, through our organization and connecting those peer hospitals together. So that's one of the really beneficial things that I'm seeing culturally in our organization. The tricky part is fostering that culture at healthcare systems across the country. We need leadership to get really excited about sustainability and get on board and, you know, support these goals. We need clinical champions to continue advocating for patient health and connect all of these dots from the emissions related to, you know, health. And we need frontline folks that are, you know, interacting in these environments to, you know, get involved in projects. There's so many projects that have come out of identifying, you know, the need in all of these different strategic areas. So to me, the work is endless. We just have to create a culture of sustainability, and that's a little bit more difficult.
Well, you certainly have converted this radio show, family doctor, clinician, researcher, leader to this. I was pretty easy, I think, to convince, but boy, I'm a fan now of what y'all are doing. So thank you so much for sharing your passion and expertise with our listeners.
Yeah, Adam, absolutely. And if you want to follow us on Instagram, Healthcare Without Harm and Practice Green Health, we put out a ton of fun visual infographics. You know, some of them are the patient beds, and it says 30 pounds because each patient bed produces 30 pounds of waste. So it's, you know, really neat to take a look at those type of impacts, and we're trying to reach, you know, audiences. We want folks to care because physicians care, the patients care, and the communities care.
We're going to actually also put a link to the Instagram. We'll also put a link, we'd love to put a link to a couple of the tools that you mentioned and the individual things that people can do and look up. We work with our health science librarians across the state, and they'll help us make sure we get that up and posted if we could.
fantastic. I think the business case is so much, it's much more readily accessible today than it was, you know, a decade ago when I was trying to pitch it as a position. You know, we've got the data. We have so many wonderful key performance indicators and aggregates of data across the country. So, yeah, the skeptics that are out there, there's a lot of data out there to show you that, you know, if you care about saving the financial side, you can. If you care about impacting your community, you can. And if you care about your patients, because eventually, you know, many of us end up as patients in some point of our lives, you know, there's a difference to be had on the patient care side.
Well, one of my favorite sayings is from your mouth to God's ears. So thank you so much, Iqbal Mihan, for being our guest today on Your Health. And we wish you well.
Thank you, Adam. And again, it's a pleasure.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send any comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And I'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I was diagnosed with a marginal ulcer. I've heard of peptic and gastric ulcers, but have never heard the term marginal ulcer and was hoping that you could educate me in common sense terms.
Well, when we think of the margin, right, former school teacher that I always wanted to be, never was, but that margin, you know, you get the ruler out and you get a margin, and it's a line. It's usually between two things. So we think about a marginal ulcer, it's the line, it's something between two things. What would cause someone to have a marginal ulcer?
So my first thought would be the gastric bypass, because there's a line caused by incision or a cut.
Where it was reattached and or stapling or something that altered the normal line, and you have a new line. And if what happens if that new line, if the tissue's too tight, you ever pull a clothesline so tight, you can't quite get it undone, and it strangulates, in this case, the tissue, you can have a suture. Mm-hmm. Sticking out, not a good thing, right?
That's right. Or you can have reflux from acid.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you could have traditional causes of ulcers, like we call this H. pylori, the organism, or a biggie, preventable
smoking.
So I think, you know, you take the history, but it's a little bit different here because we don't typically think of the marginal ulcer causes, like a gastric bypass, as the peptic ulcer. Sometimes with the treatments, some of them are the same. You could take the anti-reflux medicines, any brand you could take. A lot of times you combine things. But in this particular case, in addition to quitting smoking, checking for the H. pylori, you actually may need to have a CAT scan. You may need to look carefully to see, does the tissue need to be relaxed? Is there a suture that needs to be removed? You might even have to reverse the gastric bypass surgery.
Ouch.
Not a straightforward question. I hope the answer has provided some guidance. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I have a friend who's prescribed a medicine called Xanaflex for headaches. I've never heard of this medicine, and I was curious if it's commonly used for migraines.
Well, it's probably commonly used for a lot of things that it's probably not really indicated for anything other than spasticity of the muscles. We think about some in children who have cerebral palsy and spasticity, and that's where I've seen it used most often. But I have had some adults, you know, they say, I need a muscle relaxant. My muscles are tight in my back or shoulders, right?
I've not seen it for migraines, though. Have you?
You know, I think sometimes people take things that are sedating for migraines, and so it helps them fall asleep, which tells us what's one of the problems with Xanaflex. It can be incredibly sedating, so half the people can really be sedating. Now, if you needed to be sedated, you needed to be sleepy, it may be something good. It also has some other kinds of side effects. I think I've heard it can have hallucinations, can have your blood pressure rising, and if you stop it too quickly, you could have a rebound. Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Some rebound high blood pressure, so it needs to be tapered.
Yeah, and you know, I think people like it because it's cheap.
But there's drug-drug interactions, and so I think discussing it with your doctor and weighing the risk benefit would be wise.
Yeah, some people can actually get really dizzy because it can lower their blood pressure. So a lot of side effects. You know, people sometimes say, "Oh, it worked for someone else; it'll work for me." But it also may mean that you might have the side effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Laura, what's our very last house call?
My father's been getting sicker and recently has had several strokes, and he's gone into renal failure. Because of his age and his declining physical condition, the hospital didn't offer him dialysis. I then had a physician come by and talk to me about DNR orders. I said that I thought we should resuscitate because this has all happened so fast, but she said that it really is not indicated and is against medical advice because he has a negligible chance of surviving. Shouldn't this be mine and my father's decision?
Difficult question that we can do justice to, and actually makes me think that we probably should do a whole show and have some guests talking about medical ethics of end-of-life decisions, because this is a important topic. And, you know, it's interesting that they separate out end-of-life and the DNR. It's really one of the few decisions that we allow, for the most part, patients to choose if they want the procedure or not.
And there's controversy around this because you don't want to choose, you know, an intervention that is not going to have any
benefit.
Yeah.
Yeah, and physicians actually don't have to do futile interventions. If you think about it,
right. We
don't have to give chemotherapy if there is no benefit. And no one would really think that we should do that, but somehow we perhaps think that, well, the do not resuscitate or that decision, because we tend to allow people to make that decision, is one that can always be made by the individual, the patient, or the surrogate, but that's probably not true. You know, if you had end-stage cancer and you have liver failure and kidney failure and you were a long-time tobacco user and you have COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, you will not survive a resuscitation. And so the doctors might say, we're not going to offer that to you, even if you want it. That's a tough situation, right?
That is tough.
We'd like to see the provider and the patient on the same page, if possible.
Right, exactly.
You might have to have a third party, a medical ethicist in there to come talk about, because people might think, she's always survived before now. Mm-hmm. He's always survived before now. He's going to survive this. But it may well be that last time they didn't have kidney failure, liver failure, and had the strokes.
Exactly. That was exactly the strokes.
And things are moving so quickly here.
Yeah.
So we're so sorry for the difficulties. We know this is really difficult. We really encourage you to talk with the doctors. Sit down. Don't do it in a rush setting. Share what you're thinking. Listen to what they're thinking and see if you can't come to some better agreement.
Yep. Sounds like a good plan.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. We want to thank all of you for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can share any questions or stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our great guest today, Iqbal Mian, and our great guest co-host, Dr. Jamil Battle. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.